This podcast is part one of three titled The Nation's Next Submarine and Anti-Submarine Warfare. Today, Cyprus is honored to get a chance to discuss perspectives of two leaders in this field, with a special emphasis on the undersea warfare fight. Admiral retired Jamie Fogo and Vice Admiral retired Bruce Lindsay support Cyprus and Cyprus clients as part of our valued subject matter experts team.
Fantastic. First, we have Admiral Jamie Fogo. Some very brief highlights of the Admiral's 40-year career. He has served as Commander, Naval Forces Europe and Africa, 6th Fleet Commander, ComSub Group 8, ComSub Ron 6, and was Skipper of the USS Oklahoma City. During his multiple command tours in Europe, he was involved in protracted combat operations and the Libya campaigns, JTF Odyssey Dawn and Unified Protector. As the J-3 for Joint Task Force Odyssey Dawn, he employed the Tomahawk missile against targets inside Libya launched from U.S. surface and submarine assets in the Mediterranean. Likewise, he was commander of Naval Forces Europe and responsible for the TLAM strikes on chemical weapons facilities in Syria from USS John Warner in the Eastern Mediterranean. He presently serves as a dean of the Center for Maritime Strategy within the Navy League of the United States National Headquarters. I'm also proud and honored to note that Admiral Fogo, Jamie, served as my Commodore during my executive officer tour, and it is a distinct pleasure to get a chance to work with you on behalf of our sailors and Navy again. It is also my honor to welcome Vice Admiral retired Bruce Lindsay to our podcast. Admiral Lindsay most recently served as a Deputy Commander of U.S. Fleet Forces and Director of the Combined Joint Operations from the Sea Center of Excellence and Deputy Commander, U.S. Fleet Forces Command. He is a naval flight officer who flew the S-3 Viking anti-submarine warfare aircraft, with command tours at every level, including service as Naval Air Force Atlantic, Carrier Strike Group, and Carrier Command.
John, thanks for that introduction. And Bertie, great to see you again. You're looking good out there.
Admiral Fogo, great to be here with you today. As you know, when I was in the Navy, my job was an S-3B aviator, and I was supposed to locate, track, and finish you and your submarines. I cannot tell you how hard it was then, and I can only imagine how hard it is today. But thank goodness we have such well-equipped and well-trained submarine force, because they are, and they represent, I think, an asymmetric advantage that we have over our adversaries, specifically China and Russia. Good to be here, sir.
Hey, thanks for that, Bertie. And, you know, I'm flattered coming from a distinguished naval aviator like yourself. It is a tough game out there. And as my friend John Richardson would say, former chief of naval operations, the margins are razor thin. So this is a really important discussion today.
Fantastic. Our chief of naval operations, Admiral Gilday, tells us in his navigation plan that the United States Navy is America's away team. Alongside our allies and partners, we defend freedom, preserve economic prosperity, and keep the seas open and free. Today, we are engaged in a long-term competition. China and Russia are rapidly modernizing their militaries to challenge the international order that has benefited so many for so long. To defend our nation and interests around the globe, we must be prepared to flawlessly execute our Navy's timeless roles of sea control and power projection. We will generate decisive integrated all-domain naval power. There is no time to waste, and our actions in this decade will set the maritime balance of power for the rest of this century. One of my favorite quotes, I've used it multiple times through my career, and I believe you have used it before as well, Jamie, is, if you are seeking a new idea, read an old book. As part of our preparations for this conversation, I was reminded by you of a 2002 directive from Admiral Skip Bowman, at that time NAVC-08, to the Corps of Cadets at the Citadel, which served us as a call to action for our submarine forces and which remain relevant today. He called it the four gets.
John, you're right. You know, I worked for Admiral Bowman as his executive assistant between 2001 and 2003 over at Naval Reactors. And I will never forget those four gets. They were powerful. First one was get payload. And what Admiral Bowman was talking about there was his challenge to Naval Sea Systems Command and to industry, many of whom are listening today, to prioritize payload over platform. And that was done to attain lethality, quite frankly, with an appropriate weapon or device to outstick the enemy. He also wanted a variety of payloads, not just heavyweight torpedoes, which is traditional for the submarine force, but also Tomahawk land attack missiles, mines and room to expand for future combat or weapon systems. We're talking about hypersonics. Bertie's going to treat that later on in the podcast, but you know, he wanted a Virginia-class submarine with a reconfigurable torpedo room that would allow for innovation and advancement in future weapon systems. And he used to talk about the tyranny of the 21-inch torpedo tube. You know, why are we stuck on that? Could we consider putting hull-mounted or sail-mounted weapons out there? And there's been some innovation there, but there needs to be a lot more. And this was well before the conversion of the SSBNs to SSGNs, and well before consideration. It would have been a wild idea back in 01 to 03 to have come up with a Virginia payload module to actually insert in the hull of the USS Virginia class. So you can see it's really about, you know, getting payload and prioritizing payload over platform. The second get was get connected. And at the time, the goal was to establish comms at speed and depth. That's a heck of a lot harder than it seems. You know, we've got floating wire antennas. We have comms buoys on SSBNs. Everybody does. It's got an SSBN out there. But it's very difficult to transit at a high bell and maintain communications without having to go shallow and put your platform at risk. And so when a submarine was on independent ops, we always wanted to be plugged in. And whether we were with a battle group or not with a battle group, particularly in my command tour in Oklahoma City, we wanted to be plugged in to the common operating picture, you know, for the Navy, to have that same view that the Maritime Operations Center had before them ashore or on a carrier or another command ship on board in the control room of the submarine. And so connectivity, very, very important. And that was the second get. Before I go further, Bertie, do you have any comments on that? Because I know you're a big thinker on comms and connectivity.
Jamie, I completely agree with you on that about being connected. And this was very forward thinking back then, I believe, because today, if you look at it, connectedness is fundamental to all our operating concepts that we're developing, from distributed maritime operations, DMO, to expeditionary advanced based operations, EABO, in the Navy, and then multi-domain operations in the Army and JADC2 in the Air Force. So yes, I completely agree. Getting connected is so important, and even more so for the submarine force.
Thanks, Bertie. I thought you were going to say that. Third get modular, so we can custom tailor submarines precisely to the mission at hand. This is tough, too, because you just can't pull a section of the hull out and put something else back in. But remember at the time, I remember when Admiral Frank Pandolf came over to brief Admiral Bowman on, you know, his baby for CNO Vern Clark, Sea Power 21, the strategy that came after, you know, the forward from the sea, from the sea and forward from the sea. It had three pillars, sea shield, sea basing, and sea strike. And the littoral combat ship figured prominently in the mix, as did the proposal for the 30-ship Zumwalt class DDG-21. So LCS was going to have ASW modules, strike modules, and mine countermeasure modules, and who knows what else as the platform evolved. And the goal for Admiral Bowman was to get a similar kind of modularity for the submarine, you know, by inserting particular mission modules, perhaps in the torpedo room or in the sail. So not a bad idea, and I think still relevant today. The last of the gets, the hardest one, get electric. Admiral Bowman had studied up at, he was a Duke University graduate. He studied at MIT. He had his own patent, you know, so a brilliant guy. And he knew that we had to get from steam turbine and reduction gear drive to electric drive in our submarines, a very tall task. He also understood how hard it was going to be and how much money it was going to cost. And get this, back then, $1 billion was a lot of money, and that's what they thought they'd have to spend over at Naval Reactors. You think about the way we treat billions today, you know, it used to be $1 million was a lot, then $1 billion was a lot. Now we talk in terms of trillions of dollars. But, you know, I think about 80% of the power output of the reactor goes to propulsion through a steam plant, and that would be much less with electric drive and therefore give you energy to use for weapon systems, whatever that might be, you know, directed energy or something else. And so I think we're going to get there on Columbia. It's going to be a marvelous submarine. If you look at it, the R&D that's going on right now is intended to produce the first ship of the class by 2028. And it's supposed to be an electric drive ship. Cost is much different. You know, we're paying about $3 billion for a Virginia class. A Nimitz class carrier was $5 billion. The Ford came in at about $13.5 billion. And the first of the Columbia class, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later, a little over $15 billion, but with economies of scale, that price tag is going to come down. Worth it if we get the electric drive on that ship. Now, the bottom line on all these gets, you know, why are we talking about them? Because it's back in 2001 to 2003. It's because they're still relevant today. My classmate Tom Moore used to tell me, Vice Admiral Moore, there's 80,000 brilliant engineers and workers and contracting specialists and designers over at Naval Sea Systems Command, but they need guidance, right? And so these four gets were just perfect guideposts for those engineers and those designers and those contract specialists to try to get what we needed into the new attack submarine. And I also fondly remember, you know, he's been a friend for many years, helped me out on development of strategy. Ron O'Rourke from the Congressional Research Service, still up there, still pumping out some great papers. Every couple of months, he comes up with another one that's brilliant. But Ron was asked by the Surface Navy Association, and N86 at the time was Rear Admiral Harry Ulrich, to come and speak to SNA Symposium. And he did, and it was, you know, a little bit tongue-in-cheek for the submarine force and for Admiral Bowman, too, because Ron said, hey, you know what you guys need in the surface Navy? You need some rallying principles, simple rallying principles like Bowman's four gets. And it wasn't more than about a week till Admiral Ulrich came up with his own. I think he had more than four, you know, for the surface Navy. So, you know, I've talked about first four gets, get connected, get modular, get electric, get payload. I'd like to hear what Bertie Lindsay thinks about these. And Bertie, you know, what's relevant for today? Do you have your own list of gets for today that might be applicable to the next generation submarine or something else?
Well, Jamie, when you were talking there, I couldn't help but think that these four gets that you outlined are still very valid today. I remember Admiral Davidson, who I worked for there at Fleet Forces, he gave a talk at CSIS on fleet design, and he was talking about the four advantages of the United States Navy. And they were people, undersea warfare, which we're talking about today, integrated fire control, and modularity. And we can see that we are continually advancing on these. First, integrated fire control, as in integrated air missile defense and naval integrated fire control air, NIFCA. Those are manifestations of Admiral Bowman's get connected. And now today, that's translating into the Naval Tactical Grid, which is now evolving to the Naval Open Architecture, and it's getting really refined, I believe, in Project Overmatch to get us so connected that we can go beyond just simply being interoperable and just talking to each other, but actually achieve that higher goal that we really want, which is true integration. Integration of the effects by connecting your sensors to the shooters and to the decision makers. The second one, modularity. You know, I'm a naval aviator, so, you know, let me start about modularity conversation in how we do it in naval aviation. The air wing of the future is a continuous module swap out process. In naval aviation, besides the new pods, module swap out comes in the form of a Growler swapping out for the EA-6B, the Super Hornet for the F-18 Charlie, and the E-2D for the E-2C and Hawkeye 2000. I would even argue that the biggest swap out, modular swap outs we've done in the air wing in the last 20 years has been the F-35 Charlie for the Super Hornet and the MQ-25 for the S-3B Super Hornet combination. The latter representing the evolution from 100% manned air wing to a mix of manned and unmanned air wing that will also have modular swap out capabilities for, say, tanking, ISR, cyber. We also see in the surface Navy that we continue to make progress. LCS modules, you talked about the LCS, and we continue to grow the family of missiles that can be loaded into the VLS system. And in the undersea domain, we have the Virginia payload system, which you are well aware of. So modular swap-outs are even happening today in the software business. When you see Kessel Run and innovations and initiatives like Compile to Combat for the Navy. But you asked a good question. Are these four gets still good? I said yes, but I think we need to add some gets. I call it getting after the four A's so that we can get the Navy the nation needs. So my first A, I would say, is we have to get assets, both manned and unmanned. Now, the CNO recently discussed his vision for a 500-ship Navy, I think, out at West out there, and he's thinking about 350 manned and 150 unmanned, and I believe he's on the right path, and Congress needs to support him. The nation that develops and masters manned, unmanned fleet first will gain a strategic competitive advantage, no doubt about it. Second, get autonomy. We need to get autonomy on those unmanned assets so the concept of distributed maritime operations can be fully realized. When the enemy takes out our satellites, our manned and unmanned assets must operate autonomously as one fleet. We can do this for the manned platforms through mission command, but we need to be able to have the unmanned loyal wingmen, whether they're in the air, on the sea, or under the sea, autonomously fly or steam with purpose. And this leads to the third get artificial intelligence. We need to get AI on these assets, both manned and unmanned, so that mission command can be executed and executed faster than the enemy can react. AI will greatly enhance our decision-making capabilities and allow us to achieve what I think Speedy Spadaro said in one of his conversations, decision dominance or decision advantage. And then finally, the last A, get assured communications access. We need to get that communication surety on these manned and unmanned assets. We always see those proverbial lightning bolts on every OV1 slide. And the reason they're on there, because without that connectivity, the fleet cannot achieve the massing of the effects, the tempo, the timing necessary to win decisively and quickly. I think those four new gets, get those A's, complement Skip Bowman's original gets. What do you think, Jamie?
Hey, Bertie, I think that's fantastic. You know, first of all, the four that you bring up, assets, autonomy, AI, and assured comms access, are perfect. And they should be remembered from here on out the way Admiral Bowman's four gets were remembered. So let me offer you this. Since you're an aviator, I might suggest that you call them Bertie's four aces.
There you go. But I'm one short to get that proverbial five. So we'll have to keep thinking on that.
We might have to add another ace. Well, you know, so if we do get electric, then electric can go away and we can make room for something else. But we've got to keep working on stealth to maintain the competitive edge. And we'll talk a little bit later in the program about Severodvinsk and Belograd, the two new Russian submarines that are out there that we're battling in the fourth battle of the Atlantic. John, back to you.
That's fantastic. The current end cost of a Virginia-class submarine with the VPM is over $3 billion. And the operating costs for an SSN per year are well north of $300 million a year. Jamie, with these modified four or five gets that you all just finished talking about as framing assumptions, how would you characterize the current state of play and challenges for our submarine forces, both in strategic and conventional terms?
Yeah, okay, John. So if we're going to talk about money, yes, I served in N81, but that was more the analytical branch than N80, who was doing the bean counting and the spreadsheets there in the Pentagon. And God bless all of those young men and women that do that day in and day out with the way continuing resolutions go and POMs go. I mean, we have a generous defense budget, but, you know, the CR certainly doesn't help us out. And when it comes to costs are difficult to manage, particularly in new submarine programs. Let's talk about Columbia first. It's an absolutely essential program for the United States of America. And particularly now, in the last, you know, month, 2 weeks, from what we have seen from Russia's behavior and Vladimir Putin showing his true colors, he controls the Russian nuclear trigger today. And that's scarier than it's ever been since the end of the Cold War. You know, I was asked about this in some network interviews on CNN and CBS this past week. Is he coming unglued? And I think that Putin's prone to escalate, to de-escalate, so he wants to hit a nail with a sledgehammer and declare a nuclear alert in response to economic sanctions or the punishment that Russia is receiving from the Ukraine. But the bottom line is, when smart people like former Secretary of Defense Bob Gates say he's coming off the rails, I pay attention. So this program, the Columbia-class program for our nuclear deterrence, is essential. The cost of the program, like I said before, it's $15.3 billion. That's one estimate that has been in the public domain. The second ship should come in less than that with the shipyard learning curve at $9 billion, and then finally get down to about $7 billion. The Navy tried a campaign, a whole-of-government campaign, for, you know, the paying for this submarine, and it was not successful. So when you look at that amount of money that's got to be spent to get this essential deterrent out there for our nation, you know, the most survivable part of the triad, there's not a lot of SCN shipbuilding money left over to do anything else. And then the CNO still has a modernization and readiness bill to pay because the platforms that are afloat today are still going to be here past 2030, and they become harder to maintain. You have to spend more money on them, and our people do a great job at that. I think the right answer here is to take a really hard look at the top line. And if we can't get some relief in the president's budget from OMB or the Hill, then we really need to examine the one-third, one-third, one-third paradigm and shift resources to the United States Navy and Marine Corps. Bertie, what do you think?
I think you're right on, Jamie, because, you know, things have changed. The one-third, one-third, one-third is just a very mechanical, mathematical, easy way out. It does not put resources to where you really have the requirement for the national security of your nation. So I think that discussion needs to continue. I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. I did notice that Representative Luria did put in more money for this last round of the NDAA, but that was mainly to keep the cruisers afloat, if you will. So that's, I think, how we're going to see this go. We'll get a little bit of relief top line to help us get through this very big spike, which is for Columbia and, of course, Ford class carriers. Those are big things. But I'm with you. That SSBN, that has to be paid for. That's our number one deterrent.
Yeah, thanks, Bertie. You know, if we go back to the gets, payload's still a valid requirement. We've got to have a robust over-the-horizon strike capability. And we just can't let the Chinese outstick us with their extensive missile development program. It's absolutely amazing how many ships and how much ordnance they're producing. And this includes the development program for hypersonics, which I know Bertie's going to talk about a little later. So I'll talk about TLAM as a program of record and one of the most successful and used weapons in our inventory, because a lot of these weapons over time in combat operations have been launched from submarines. So it's an essential ingredient. TLAM's an essential ingredient of our maritime strategy and our national defense strategy. It's lethal, it's unmanned, an air-delivered strike weapon, and it's accurate. So if your intel is good, you can minimize collateral damage. Something that is important to Americans, not very important to Russians from what we can see in Ukraine. And I'll just stop there. You know, we used TLAM extensively in the Libya campaign. We struck many targets during that campaign in Odyssey Dawn that were warehouses containing mines, coastal defense cruise missiles, and the weapon destroyed all the contents in, and in many cases left the building intact, so minimal collateral damage. USS Florida was a big player in that campaign. She shot over 110 Tomahawks. That's amazing. So as the SSGNs go out of service, thinking about this weapon, which is an essential part of our arsenal and our strategy, we've got to come up with some kind of a risk mitigation strategy. The last duty that I had before I retired was as Commander of Naval Forces Europe. And in April 2018, USS John Warner shot at Syrian chemical weapons sites from the Eastern Mediterranean. And the Russians who were out there in anticipation of these strikes really couldn't do anything about it. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, too. But we've got to have this capability, and we've got to be able to strike with TLAM from under the sea. So the risk mitigation I talk about is in decommissioning the SSGNs is the 84-foot-long Virginia payload module. And it'll be inserted in the Virginia-class submarine midsection. It has four large-diameter tubes for additional TLAM or payloads, such as the large-diameter UUV. And with 28 additional TLAMs per boat, that increases the number of weapons that the boat can carry from 37 with vertical launch to 75. Not bad, and well worth the investment. If you look at the numbers, John, you know, you talked about the numbers earlier. Again, Ron O'Rourke in the Congressional Research Service reported in September 2021 that a Virginia-class boat is $3 billion. With the Virginia payload module, it's about $3.5 billion. So it's about $500 million. I think that's a pretty good return on investment. John, back to you.
I'm right with you, Jamie. I am so proud of my contributions to the force, and I cannot wait to see these VPM boats hit the fleet. I think they will represent a step change in capacity and conventional deterrence for our nation. Bertie, given that these submarines are such a requirement to deterring the future fight and is required, to fight and win, how does our nation field a large enough force to credibly make a difference against a Chinese Navy that is already larger than ours right now, growing faster than ours, and for all intents and purposes only has one ocean to defend and operate in versus America's worldwide commitments?
Well, that's a good question, John. As I mentioned earlier before, the CNO talked about a requirement for a 500-ship Navy comprised of about 350 manned and 150 unmanned. That's his vision. He says his vision has a solid analytical rigor behind it, and I agree with him. However, I think the CNO needs to think bigger. If John Layman thought we needed 600 ships in a bipolar world when we were worried only about the Soviet Union, I think we probably need at least 600-ship Navy for the tripolar world that we face today that has both China and Russia aligning against the U.S., our allies, our partners, and our friends. Well, we don't have the money to build the John Layman 600-manned ship Navy. However, we probably have the money to do it differently because technology has advanced to the point where unmanned ships make great sense for many reasons. Unmanned reduces your per unit cost for platforms when you build them because you don't have to have all those extra systems like CHT. Unmanned reduces our manpower requirements. Unmanned reduces total operating cost, total ownership cost, and unmanned can increase the number of platforms carrying payloads, going back to Skip Bowman's gets. Unmanned enables truly the Navy to achieve the critical mass of units required for DMO and EABO to succeed. You know, those are good concepts, but you have to have critical mass to execute them. And then unmanned enables the Navy to survive a war of attrition with China or Russia because the unmanned assets are or could be attritable depending on how you build them. So we need to get after the four A's that I mentioned earlier. And unmanned allows us to do that, to get after all of the A's, because unmanned can come with autonomy, it can come with artificial intelligence, it can come with assured communications access, all baked in and able to be software upgradable. Think about that modularity we talked about earlier. I think the Navy the nation needs has to be a big, audacious goal, one that Congress and the American citizens can rally around, like going to the moon was in the 1960s or going to Mars today. Hence, I argue for a 21st century 600-ship Navy comprised of 300 manned and 300 unmanned naval ships or vehicles. And I just throw that out. But what if? What if we built two unmanned light amphibious warships for every manned LAWs we built? Here's one. How about we build 150 extra large unmanned undersea vehicles so we can have two XLUUV wingmen for every attack submarine? You know, I'm an aviator, so I got to put it in that perspective. I think a Virginia would love to have two wingmen out there. It gives them at least the odds if they're getting shot goes from 1-1 down to 1 out of 3. What if we built 40 VLS Arsenal unmanned ships so we have 4 unmanned Arsenal ships for every carrier strike group? Oh, by the way, they could be under the sea or on the sea Arsenal ships. I don't think we're up to the in-the-air kind yet. And what if we build 50 unmanned logistics ships so we have the capacity to logistically supply our Navy across the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans? That rough math right there outlines 300 unmanned ship or vehicle plan, all with artificial intelligence, with autonomy, assured communications access built in. And this could be the foundation for the next 30-year shipbuilding plan to Congress. This is a big, audacious goal, but heck, isn't that what Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos have taught us? Go big or go home? Okay, I believe American innovativeness, American ingenuity, American increased productivity, what I call the three I's, can get us there. Over to you, John.
Thank you very much for that answer. A lot to consider, especially with regard to the unmanned component of what a future force structure would look like. That's all for this week, and we look forward to continuing this conversation in the near future with a conversation on undersea launched weapons.